Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The city of Mokena, Illinois, hadn't seen a murder for over a quarter of a century. However, this would change in May 2009, when the killing of a little girl would send shockwaves through the community. Whilst the brutal murder of any child is a horrific crime, this one would prove even more shocking. Why? Because this savage killing would be carried out by a relative of the victim, somebody barely older than the child himself. The only thing more shocking would be his justification for the crime. This is a disturbing case of Keith Randalich. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's get on with today's case. So, 18-year-old Keith Randalich. He's born on the 16th of April, 1991. He lived in Mokena, Illinois. He lived with his mother. She was called Anne Clement. And he had a stepfather and also two younger brothers. They were 14 and 16 years of age. He also had a stepsister, four-year-old Sabrina Clement. So that was his family makeup. Now, Randalich was a Lincoln Way East High School honor student. So when I've looked at his background, particularly academically, well, by all accounts, he was an excellent student. He scored really high grades. In fact, he was an A student across the board, aside from a C in English. So we're talking about a really bright kid. He was thriving. He'd been well-behaved at school. Nothing was notable about him as far as interactions with other young people. He was certainly not a bully. It wasn't necessarily noted that he had been bullied at school. But what some of the students said was he had a kind of unusual character. So he didn't have a lot of friends. He tended to keep himself to himself. To some degree, he had that loner genre about his personality, but not to a degree where people thought he was weird or strange, just somebody who liked to be a little bit more isolated than other peers would have. He'd also won prizes for perfect attendance, so he went to school day in, day out. Again, I say that because when young people are really struggling, when they're dealing with problems in their mainstream provider, particularly if they're dealing with bullying, then they're going to often create scenarios and bruises to avoid going in. And he doesn't. That's why he wins those prizes for perfect attendance. And the crime that I'm going to talk about, well, it takes place 1 week away from him actually graduating. So we're at the very end of him being at a point educationally where he's succeeded and thrived. And all the evidence to this point is indeed that he was thriving. We get to the 22nd of May, this is 2009. Now, Randalich has recently turned 18, and his mother and stepfather, they go out to a school dance event. This is with his 14-year-old brother. So this leaves Randalich and his 16-year-old brother to basically be in charge of Sabrina. His parents, when they left for that school dance that evening, not within their wildest nightmares could they ever have conceived the events that were going to play out. And I mean that. Not within the greatest stretch of their imagination could they have imagined what they would return to. The horrific events that were about to unfold just seemed to come like a bolt out of the blue. Now, earlier the night before the parents go to this dance, Randalich has basically had an argument with his mother I am sure that all of us who have ever been a teenager can appreciate what it is like to fall out with our primary caregivers. There's nothing untoward or unusual there, is there? We often find ourselves at odds with those who believe that they control us because they're our parents. But he'd got into this altercation. The reasoning behind it was a little bit concerning though. He'd basically obtained a firearm permit the previous week and he decided that he wanted to use some of his high school graduation money to buy a gun. His mum had said, no, I don't want you to use your high school graduation money to go out and buy a gun. Instead, you're gonna have to go out and if you wanna get one, you have to work for it. Personally, I'd be like, no. Why? Because I don't want you having a gun. Why? We all have bad days, don't we? Personally, that's why I wouldn't want somebody having a gun. Because you know, you have a bad day, somebody annoys you, you get annoyed with yourself, and you have a gun available to you. I just don't think it ends well often. So his mother said, no, he can't use this money, but he can save up and get one himself. So he's really annoyed. And at this point he says, well, the way I'm gonna deal with that is I'm gonna tell you that I wanna move out. I'm gonna go move into a friend's home. Again, so many young people do this. You're having a row with a caregiver. They won't give you what you want, so you decide that there's going to be this all or nothing response and reaction, such as, I'm leaving you. I'm going to go and live on a friend's couch, because that seems like a better idea than being paid for and cooked for and cleaned for and having my own room. You do those things. Same as when you were a little kid and you were like, right, I'm really angry about the way you've just treated me. I'm not going to eat my tea. As if starving yourself is somehow a punishment for your caregiver. But that's the kind of moves that we make. It shows an emotional immaturity, but it's also very commonplace. He also, down the line, when he's talking to the police about what plays out, says, look, I didn't actually want to leave home. I just was angry with my mum and I was just venting that anger. So, as I said, his parents leave, they go to this dance, and it's actually his younger brother who's with Sabrina. At that point, they're watching TV in the living room. The reason it seems that the mother hadn't left Randalich in charge was because of the fact that they'd had this row. So because of this issue between them, she had decided to leave the younger son in charge of the younger daughter. This means that Randalich is ending up in the kitchen doing some dishes and he's kind of cleaning up. And for whatever reason, he takes a 5-inch steak knife from the kitchen cabinet and he tucks it into the front pocket of his hoodie. So we can see at this moment in time that whilst he's washing those dishes in the kitchen, something's going through his mind enough to spur him on to take that 5-inch steak knife, to tuck it in the pocket of his hoodie, but then also to actually go and see his brother and to tell his brother that he would watch Sabrina instead. And that means that his brother then goes up to his room to play video games, and this would be completely normal. Let's be honest, if you've been left in charge of a younger sibling and your older sibling says, hey, I'll do that for you, you go and play video games, there's not going to be required much incentive to make you absolutely vacate said premises and go to your room and get on with your own life and things that you enjoy doing. So at the end of the day, Randalich knows that his brother will do this. So there's a trusted scenario there, isn't there? As far as Sabrina's brother is concerned, his elder brother is a safe person. Of course he's going to leave him with her. So now Randalich and his little sister, they go into the basement bedroom, which was his, and they start watching SpongeBob SquarePants. Sabrina then says, will you play with me? As you would imagine, for a child of her age, being around an older brother is going to be fun, and she would have played lots of games with him before. So she just asks him to contribute in that respect. So she wanted to do some painting. Randalich says, yeah, I'm going to do that with you, sure. But he asks her first to lie on the floor. She's a little girl. This is her very big brother. Absolutely, she's going to lie on the floor. So she obediently lies back on the basement floor. Why wouldn't she? This is somebody that she trusts and she probably believes that they're about to play a game together. And she knows that if she does do what he's asked, then they're going to get to do the activity that she suggested that she wants to do. Randalich then kneels down in front of her. He then tells her that he loves her, and he takes the knife from his pocket. Apparently she innocently smiles up at him, and then he puts the blade to her neck and he makes a small cut. Now at this point you can appreciate that Sabrina has gone from a position of trust to a position of fear, and apparently her smile just turned to a look of horror and she screams, "No, stop." Randalich later told police that once he produced the knife, his words, by the way, he said, "I knew right then that I had to kill my little sister because she saw it. There was no going back at that point. I just started doing it again. She grabbed her neck, but I just kept going." Now, I think we can all take issue with that particular quote on the basis that this is a very small child who may, yes, have seen a knife and, yes, may have been cut a small amount by that knife, but that should at no point stop that person who's perpetrating that crime realizing what they're doing and withdrawing the attack. The fact that he believes that because he started, he has to carry on says something very strange about this perpetrator. Now, Randalich, he held Sabrina down as she's struggling, and she is struggling. She's screaming for her life. She can't believe that her big brother is doing this, and she actually shouts out, "Why are you killing me?" Can you imagine that? We're talking about an infant. An infant who's being brutally slain by her big, trusted brother. And she knows it's happening. I think that's what's really distressing about this. She knows it's happening. She's asking him, "Why are you killing me?" That little girl weighed less than 3 stone. She didn't even stand a chance. Randalich grabs her and he repeatedly slashes and stabs at her neck. And he said that he continued to do that until he felt bone. When down the line, he's asked to describe his actions during that attack, he said that he acted like a maniac. Now, by this point, Sabrina has stopped talking, but he notices that she's still breathing and he says that she has her eyes open. It's at this point he drops the knife. He runs upstairs and then he calls emergency services. And he actually spoke only 3 words to the call handler before he hung up. He said, "Come over quick." Now, after making that call, Randalich goes back down into the basement, and it's at this point that he looks at Sabrina, and as far as he's concerned, it looks like she's died. But even though what I've described seems to have played out quite quickly, the reality is that Sabrina's death would not necessarily have been quick. They believe it probably took around 4 to 5 minutes. And bear in mind, much of that would be her struggling to comprehend what has happened, in pain, struggling to breathe, not understanding what has played out, wanting her mummy, wanting her daddy, all the things that a little girl would want in that situation. And some of that time she would have been alone as well. He said that when he went down and noticed that she was no longer breathing, he kissed Sabrina and he told her, "I'm sorry. I had to do that." So we're introduced automatically into his belief system at this moment in time. So he's suggesting there was not an element of choice within his actions. "I had to do that." He's sorry, but he had to do that. Now, after a few minutes, he goes ahead and he calls emergency services again. Speaks only 3 words. This time, before he hangs up, he says, "Get over here." Of course, the authorities at this point are not aware that his stepsister has bled to death on the basement floor. But as is the case with emergency services, when you ring and you put the phone down, often they call back. And at this point, Randalich actually tells the dispatcher that he's murdered his sister with a knife. The police are immediately dispatched. on the arrival of the property on York Drive just before 8 p.m. When they arrive, Randulich is literally waiting for them at the front door. He is covered, and I mean covered, in blood. All of his trousers are covered. His sweatshirt is covered. Even his hands and his face, all of him just drenched in this child's blood. Now, don't get me wrong, a lot of that blood had dried because there had been a time period between him killing her and the dispatchers arriving. And immediately, when he's confronted by the officers, he just says, "It was me." By the way, throughout this, there's not going to be a point where we're not talking about a young man who takes full responsibility for his actions. Him saying, "It was me," is something that he sustains throughout this. There is no detraction from that reality. Now, whilst this is all kicking off, we've got Randulich's brother, who's in his bedroom, who's been playing video games, and he suddenly starts realising that there are flashing lights from patrol cars outside his house. So, of course, he's like, "What's going on?" The first thing you're going to do is be like interested in what's going on in the area that you live. If it looks like there could be some kind of emergency playing out, little does he know that the emergency is playing out in his own home. He goes downstairs and he sees the police in the house, and then he looks and he sees his brother Randulich, and he's literally soaked in blood. At this point, the officers tell both the boys to get down on the floor and they hang.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Handcuffed them, they searched them, and they ask if any weapons are on either of them. Randulich states, "I've got the knife, it's in the basement with my stepsister." And the officer then says, "Who's died?" And Randulich says, "It's his sister who's died." Now, at this point, bear in mind, his brother is completely confused. He sees flashing lights. He's been playing his video game. He's come downstairs. The police are in his home. His brother's covered in blood. Suddenly he's on the floor being searched by the police. And then he's hearing his own brother telling the police that his sister is dead. And he becomes absolutely hysterical. He demands to know what's happened to Sabrina. He's absolutely beside of himself. Now, whilst this is all happening and Randulich's brother is asking what on earth has happened, the officers are looking around at this incredibly large trail of blood. And it is a trail of blood. They can literally follow it. It's on the floor. It goes from the front door through the kitchen. It's all over the telephone. But in spite of Randulich kind of talking about the fact that there is a victim, they can't see anyone. They can't see a sign of anyone who's actually injured. So they then follow up asking Randulich where his stepsister is, and he says she's in the basement. The officers descend the stairs. There's a trail of blood on here too. And of course, they are met with an absolutely catastrophic, horrific sight. They find Sabrina lay on her back in this incredibly large pool of blood. She's dressed in her blue and pink pajamas. Her top's pulled up around her chest, and they notice that her throat had been slashed and stabbed, and I mean multiple times. They see the bloodstained knife. It's literally lying between her feet, and that little girl is pronounced dead at the scene. During the observations, the officers also notice that there's a collection of horror films, death metal music, a clown mask made of rubber, and they also managed to turn up later down the line what they described as disturbing writings by a family member. They were mostly stories, song lyrics, but it turns out that all of that wasn't related to Randulich. It wasn't him who'd written them. But at this moment in time, what they're looking at seems pretty macabre when you parallel it with the fact that they've just discovered this poor child's body. When the established House Sabrina died, in total it was established that she died from sharp force injuries to the neck. And that little girl had been stabbed and slashed over 20 times, and it had been so severe that she'd almost been decapitated. Think about the escalation of what I just talked about. The area that this murder occurred had not seen a homicide in a quarter of a century. And now we're talking about one of the most brutal types of killings, the murder of a little girl. Add to that the murder of a little girl by somebody that she trusted, by somebody who she lay on that floor for because she fully believed that she was safe with him. The whole community is absolutely stunned. The fact that they have not had a history of many homicides means that it is even more outstanding when they start exploring what's gone on in this murder. Then we have, of course, Randall Litch's parents arriving home. They've been out at a school dance. They've left their little girl safely in the care of family members, and suddenly they turn up. It's an emergency crime scene. The neighbours are able to recount, in fact, what it was like when they saw the mother realising what's played out. She was screaming, she was crying, and she's screaming, "What do you mean, my baby girl? Why can't I go in the house?" And officers physically have to hold her back, which any parent, stroke anybody who cares about any child in this world would know how that feels. You believe that your child is at risk or has been harmed. The only thing that you want to do is to go in and try to make them safe. And even if the worst has happened, you want to be beside them. You want to be with them. You know that you're the person that they would be calling for in those moments. And even if you couldn't protect them during that attack, you'd want to know that you could be there for them after it, in life or death. Now, Randalich's brother, the one who hasn't actually been involved in the crime, but has been at the house when it's played out, initially would be considered a suspect, but it's very quickly that he is released. They realise he had nothing to do with it. Then we have the police interrogation, and Randalich is incredibly cooperative with the detectives, and he's calm. He's coherent. It's actually disconcerting for me to think that somebody could be calm and coherent after all but decapitating a member of their family. Now, at the time of the interrogation, he's wearing the same clothes, so his trousers are just covered in blood. And you can see when the interrogators initially sit down, and this is really important, part of interrogation is you try to build a level of rapport with the person that you're speaking to because you want them to feel at ease, you want them to be able to admit what they've done. If you can create that scenario where it doesn't feel too foreign and there is a level of amicability about it, then the chances are you may get a confession. So they start asking general questions about his school, for example. They say, "Are you going to graduate soon?" Randalich replies, "I was." So immediately, he's accepting that culpability. He knows he's not going to graduate. He knows that it's game over as far as his education is concerned. You know, he's evidently aware of the consequences of his actions. And then he tells investigators, "I had a future. I didn't do this for no reason." So he's trying to let the investigators know straight away that whilst this seems brutal, despicable, the execution, you could say, of this little girl, he's trying to offer them a reasoning behind it, that there wasn't a choice, that he's done this, and he's done this for a reason that he's going to explain and that hopefully they will understand. And it's at this point that Randalich starts to give his account of the actions after school that day. Because bear in mind, when I say this has been unprecedented in this family, this is so outside the realms of what this family have experienced that it is incompatible almost with reality that this has occurred. So clearly everyone wants to know how we can go from him being at school after an ordinary school day to all but decapitating somebody he's meant to love. Now, he begins to talk and he does appear to get more agitated the more he speaks. So there are certain behaviours that we see. He begins wringing his hands, and that's a self-soothing mechanism. It also demonstrates anxiety. And whilst he is clearly feeling a level of agitation, it makes sense when he starts talking about his utterly bizarre and utterly shocking reasoning behind his actions. So you are all going to have to strap in to try to unpick the logic that this young man is trying to suggest gives license to the actions that I have described in the killing of this little girl, Sabrina. So he says the reason that he's murdered her is because she was being abused by another family member on a daily basis.
I never wanted to hurt my sister. I just wanted to protect her from my... That's it. But if you want to hear how she died, I don't know.
Okay. Was she laying on the ground?
Yes. And
so you told her to lay down?
Right. And she was fully conscious and she was talking to me during it.
Let that sink in. So he has viciously, violently executed this child who has done nothing wrong because she is being abused by somebody else. Now, no details are actually available about the identity of the alleged abuser because the claims were never going to be substantiated. So there's no evidence that's aligning what he's talking about right now. So Randalich goes on to say that he'd actually confided in his parents about this. He'd told them many, many times that Sabrina was being abused. And he claims that basically they had done nothing. In fact, they said, stop being a snitch. They'd laughed at him. Arguably made him feel that he wasn't being taken seriously and suggested that what he's saying was absolute nonsense. Even additionalized that with the suggestion that, well, if it is true, you telling us that would make you a snitch. So at best, he's saying they're ignoring it. At worst, he's saying they are accepting it and blaming him for not knowing how to keep his mouth shut. Randalich, then after giving this reasoning behind the fact that he'd apparently been going on about the abuse his sister had been suffering for years, goes on at this point to admit that he killed his sister by himself. So he makes it very clear to the investigators and the interrogators that his brother had literally nothing to do with the killing. Then, without very much prompting at all, he goes on to talk about exactly what he did to her. So during this account, when he starts to express what he did, he does become visibly more agitated. So there's a lot more hand-wringing. You can hear emotion in his voice. His voice is shaking. And he actually gives the officers a warning. He says, it's very disturbing. So let's just take a moment to acknowledge that this is an individual who is acutely aware of their actions to such a degree that they're aware of how describing those actions to an officer of the law is going to be disturbing for that officer of the law to hear. So he is highly compos mentis at this moment in time. Now again, he brings in this distortion and he says he just wanted to protect her. So Randalich goes on to explain that initially he'd actually wanted to buy a gun, but his mum had said that he couldn't have a gun at that point, and because of that, it meant that he wasn't going to be able to kill Sabrina's bigger, stronger abuser. So arguably, his first port of call for this crime is to kill the person that he is suggesting, not backed up by evidence, but suggesting is abusing his little sister. But he recognises that as an individual, he isn't that strong, so he can't just go ahead and kill the relative unless he has a gun. Meaning that because he can't get a gun, it's going to be impossible. So he decides instead to kill Sabrina, which is warped logic beyond belief, isn't it? It's warped logic on steroids. So he's painting this picture of this protective peer stroke sibling who simply wants to stop this little girl's pain enduring any further. And whilst, yes, he could have chanced it and apparently murdered the person who was the abuser, he realises that that might not happen, so isn't it better to just snuff out the life of this little girl? But this is genuinely the story that he's telling. Now, I know that a lot of you will also think, well, that's quite delusional. To have a belief system that is so warped and so incongruent with reality suggests that there is something going on within his psyche. And I won't deny that. But certainly for the officers listening to this case, it would have been unusual. First of all, he's denying nothing. Secondly, he's acknowledging how it's played out. He's also giving a background as to the reasoning to why he's carried out this crime. And he's even forthcoming with the way that he did it. So at no point is this kid trying to get away with murder. He then asked the detectives whether he could avoid describing the killing again in court if he tells them about it at this point. So even though he is very forthcoming, he's not enjoying discussing what he's done to that little girl. He's struggling with it. He really didn't like to talk about it. And he adds to this the fact that he really loved his sister. And one of the problems that he had in the way that he killed her was it was his intention that he was going to kill her as quickly as possible. And in his mind, he had envisaged that slitting her throat was going to be the fastest way. But after he started attacking her, he realized he was wrong. He realized that that was not going to be a quick way for her to die. He said that she was in extreme pain. He noted that she screamed and she fought for her life. And even though he's wanted to go through with this killing, this is not something that he's found palatable. The fact that he has these images and memories of this child that he's meant to love, literally like a warrior trying to fight for her life, that's something he's finding disconcerting. Now, the detectives ask Randalich to basically explain, why do you think you're protecting her? You know, at the end of the day, just gonna throw it out there. Why did you think killing her, thus ending any opportunity for her to go on and live a nice life full of love, family, future, all the things that go with it, why would you think that killing her was a better option than letting her live? And he says in response to this, I'm not proud of that. There's no excuse for it. So he's not really answering the question. He's just acknowledging that he doesn't have a feeling of pride behind that action. He also, at this point, admits that it was premeditated, and he said that he...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
He'd come home from school that day, and at the end of that school day, he'd kind of decided it was going to happen. He'd been planning it from that point. He said, I'm not insane. I don't want to go for a case where people plea that I'd lost my mind in that moment. And he also explained that he would have sooner gotten out of the way the actual abuser as opposed to Sabrina. So at no point is he saying he didn't intend to murder somebody. He's just saying that if he had his time again, he would rather have killed the person that he believes is abusing his sister. Now, there is never a reason to just kill. Absolutely. The idea of just killing is not real. I know that some of us feel it like you touched one of my children, I would believe it was right to potentially do you some damage. In my mind, there is a just reason behind it. But let's be honest, if we all went around carrying out that kind of retribution, well, it would be a bit like living in the purge on a daily basis. But what we do have in these cases is when people find out that somebody is being horribly abused by somebody that they know, and then they act in a way that is illegal, because they might be violent to them. There have been cases where, for example, paedophiles have been murdered when a parent of a child abused by them has discovered that crime and they've just lost it. Even though we know it's still not correct, we have an empathy with the reasoning behind it. So for example, if Sabrina really had been being abused by somebody and he had then been violent towards that person, we would have had some kind of compassion for him. The chain of causation would seem more obvious, but it isn't. So he's now acknowledging that if he'd had the ideal scenario play out, Sabrina would still be alive. He also bizarrely goes on to say, Sabrina was the person I loved most in my family. She was my best friend. He goes on to claim that they'd always been close. And during the interrogation, one of the things that you can tell that the interrogators want to do is to figure out whether there is some kind of sexual motive to the killing. And Randalich doesn't actually understand initially what they're insinuating. But the minute that he kind of connects with the fact that they might be suggesting that he has a predilection for children, he kind of starts laughing and he says, I don't like little children. And it's strange for me, because if you think about the gravity of the situation, the little laugh whilst he denies liking little children doesn't tally with what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a child's murder. But what we could argue is psychologically, this is a young man who is starting to focus on exactly what he has done, and the gravity of his actions mean that he is completely shocked. And the strenuous denial of the suggestion that he says about the sexual element towards his sister is probably because, bear in mind, he is telling authorities, I am protecting her. I was protecting her. Therefore, to suddenly have somebody introduce the fact that, well, are you a protector or are you a predator, would be really upsetting for him. And whilst he giggles to deny it, arguably it's because he can't quite get his head around why they would imagine he would ever be attracted to somebody that he's just murdered to protect from abuse. So it's confusing. But the police then go on to say, how could you hurt something so beautiful? And the emotional playbook they're using there is powerful, because when somebody's murdered an individual, you want to bring that individual into human focus, particularly if they've got a relationship with that person. You want to breathe life back into their bones, so to speak, by making them more emotionally connected to that person. So the officer is saying, you know, this little girl, she was beautiful. She was somebody who deserved to have this life ahead of her, and you've taken that. How could you do that? And again, at this point, the officers are met with the same statement. He says that the abuse for his sister had been getting worse and worse, and that he didn't want her to have to confront that again and again. He then repeats that messaging about the fact that originally he'd intended to take out Sabrina's abuser, and he says that he would be here just about a 14-year-old instead of a 4-year-old. So he's saying, I would still be in this situation being interrogated, but you wouldn't be asking me questions about my sister because I would have killed the 14-year-old responsible for her abuse. Again, he keeps going on about this belief that what he did to her, bearing in mind the fact that he's almost decapitated this little girl, she's died in the most traumatic and terrifying of times in situations that anybody could even wrap their head around. And she's a little girl, she's 4. And he still sticks to this idea that him doing that, him ending her life in that moment, was far better than allowing her to endure the suffering that she's dealing with every day. He goes on to tell the detective that he's got absolutely nothing to hide and that he just wants to get all of this over with so that he can accept his punishment. So he isn't even for a second trying to deny responsibility. He's not trying to minimize his actions, aside from the fact that he's given an excuse that he sees as reasonable, as distorted to the rest of us as that may seem. So he knows that he's not going home. He knows that these consequences have got huge ramifications, lifelong implications, and that his freedom is not going to be negotiable anymore. But he kind of just wants to fast track to that point. Now, detectives still have a lot of questioning to do, and they say to him, okay, so why didn't you kill your sister when you first got home from school? You know, if it had been in your mind and you'd made that decision, what ultimately stopped you from going ahead in that moment? So he says, well, my stepfather was at home, and if I had started to kill her and there was any chance of anyone stopping me, I didn't want that possibility to play out. He even goes on to say that the reason behind that was because if he'd started to slash Sabrina's throat, she'd have been horribly disfigured. She'd have had breathing difficulties for the rest of her life if he'd been stopped partway through. So at no point, even when he's being questioned about this horrific play out of events, is trying to suggest that he even wished it hadn't happened. He's kind of saying, I made sure that if I was going to kill her, there was absolutely no way that it wasn't going to happen, that we were going to absolutely get the result that I intended. He then said that if he could go back in time, he would basically get a job so that he could afford a gun, so that he could kill the abusive relative. So he's trying to think about how this situation could have ended differently. And the main part of this is that he would still be a murderer, but he would have chosen a different victim. But it's intriguing. There is a curiosity within my mind, because this is somebody who at no point is saying, oh, I've made this terrible mistake. I'm really deeply regretful of this, and I shouldn't be here at all. This is somebody saying, well, you know, truthfully, I've killed her. It's more regretful than if I had killed the abuser. But if I could have afforded a gun, I would still be here because I would have killed the abuser. So murder was always on his mind. It was just the victim that potentially shifted. Now, police would later go on, of course, to speak to Randall Lynch's parents. And his stepfather actually said, you know what? On reflection, he had been acting strangely, but he was one of those kids that always kept himself to himself, didn't have a lot of friends. But one of the things that his stepfather said was, I genuinely look at the way he acted around us, and I felt like we had a good relationship. He got along with everyone in the family. But his mother, Anne Clement, she told police a different story. She said that Randall Lynch actually didn't get on with other family members except Sabrina. So his mother validates what Randall Lynch himself says about the relationship that he has with his sister, that he loves her and that he connects with her more than anyone else. And so this adds even more confusion when you think about what this young man has done to this little girl. And Anne Clement, his mother, says that she did feel that she had problems with Randall Lynch. He was rude. He was disrespectful to other family members. She claimed that he had been physically violent towards her, that he'd been physically violent towards one of his brothers on past occasions. I think we also have to be mindful, though, that she would be being asked these questions after the death of her gorgeous little girl, murdered by a child that she gave birth to. That is going to be incredibly challenging for her. So she will be looking for any fractures in his behavior that would add up to the possibility of him being this violent perpetrator. So it's difficult to know if what Anne told the police was 100% truth, or whether it was just grief and anger talking. Also, they ask her about the abuse, clearly, because he's told the police that this little girl has been living in such a terrible experience day to day that he has had to snuff out her life because he couldn't cope with what she was suffering. And Anne says there has never been any evidence that Sabrina had suffered any abuse whatsoever. None. She doesn't recall any of these conversations that Randalich has suggested that they've had. She doesn't corroborate that at times he's said about the abuse and that they've laughed at him and called him a snitch. It just, as far as she is concerned, is not reality. So when they do the autopsy, they're going to look for any sexual abuse that's occurred. Of course they are. The autopsy corroborates exactly what Anna said. There is no evidence of sexual abuse. And that's of any kind, according to the autopsy. So to date, even now, those abuse allegations remain unproven. We get to the 23rd of May, 2009. This is the day after the killing. Randalich, you will be unsurprised to discover, was charged with first degree murder, and there was a bond set for him at $10 million. Psychiatric assessments carried out, and they ultimately find that he's psychologically fit to stand trial. Again, when you think about his interrogation, his lucidity, his ability to express himself and describe why he's carried out the crime, his reasoning behind it, and also the fact that he wants to accept the charges, it's very unsurprising that he is seen as fit to stand trial. They do, during the evaluation, establish that he has a personality disorder, but I haven't been able to discover what type of personality disorder he was diagnosed with. December 2009, Randalich enters a blind plea of guilty to a first-degree murder charge. Now, a blind plea, well, that's unusual, because it's when a defendant enters a guilty plea, but they don't even get to a point of accepting the recommendation or any deal from the state. And that means that they are basically saying, I'm guilty, I'm holding my hands up, I don't care what the state do to me, I'm guilty, let them do their worst. So they plead guilty without any idea of what the punishment will be. So he's stood true to what he said at the very beginning of this, which is that he is fully culpable, he knew what he was doing, and he recognises there's going to be consequences. On the 14th of April 2011, this is almost 2 years after that little girl was brutally murdered, Randalich attends court for his sentencing. None of his family were present. And it's hard to imagine how the family would feel, because this would be a boy that has been loved in their life, but the conflict that would be felt, knowing that he's about to be sentenced for the horrific slaughter of his little sister, I imagine exposing yourself to that, knowing that there is not going to be a positive outcome, is going to be very traumatizing for anyone. So it doesn't surprise me that his family are not present. During this sentencing, the defense attorney submits 7 letters of support. And one of those letters of support was from Randalich's mother, Anne Clemen, and she urged the judge to have mercy. She said, "We trust that God has forgiven Keith. We hope that your honour in sentencing Keith will follow the same mercy." Have to say, what a difficult position to be in as a mother. Because in our usual circumstances, if somebody murdered your child, my God, you would want to absolutely do the same to them in so many circumstances. I appreciate that there are some people out there who are like, just full of forgiveness. There are, I've worked with families where a child has been murdered and they genuinely extend forgiveness to the individual who's culpable, not because they want them to walk free, but because they know that it's the only way that they can set the binds of bitterness between them and that perpetrator that allows them to carry on living their life without being held back to that moment of the murder. But again, it takes somebody that I think has a gargantuan ability for patience, forgiveness, and compassion. And in this moment, the fact that his mother is saying, please give him mercy, he's caused her the ultimate agony, the loss of a child in the most traumatic of circumstances and the most traumatic of grief, which is murder. And here she is, albeit not in person, but in written form, turning up for him. The prosecutor stated that 4-year-old Sabrina had suffered numerous massive stab wounds to the neck. They urged the judge to impose a life sentence or at least 60 to 100 years to be served because it was considered that the crime was so brutal and so heinous. And of course, one of the very aggravating factors is that the child was younger than 12 years of age. The prosecutor wanted to guarantee that Randalich never walked free, never was allowed to pose a risk to anyone else ever again. The state attorney stated this. This was a crime of unspeakable cruelty and horror. Sabrina Clement trusted and loved her brother unconditionally, and she suffered terror and agony at his hands in the last moments of her short life. Randalich absolutely 100% maintained that he had decided to kill his sister to protect her from further abuse. He stated this. I heard what the state's attorney said. Did he grow up in a household where a 4-year-old was being abused every day? He shouldn't even be allowed to judge me. I did it to stop child abuse. Now, at this point, I think it is deeply telling that he is combative towards an attorney who is challenging whether a man who has murdered a child in such a heinous way should ever be allowed his freedom. Understandably, if you are responsible and accountable for this kind of crime, showing a level of accountability and emotional context in this moment is essential. But he doesn't do that. In that moment when he speaks about not being judged, that ideally no one should be allowed to judge him because he was a protector, we see there is a huge delusion there as far as I'm concerned. That is a detachment from reality of a magnitude that's rare. He's literally saying that he's the knight in shining armor, willing to pay the price for his protection by spending his life in prison, because that's what it was about. It was about protecting that little girl. We can all see how utterly distorted that is. Because let's take the worst case scenario. Let's take the worst case scenario that this little girl, where there is no evidence to suggest this is the case, but just let's pose this as a theory, where this little girl is being sexually molested. Are you telling me that therapy, being removed from her environment and placed somewhere safe, having a future where she could lead a pro-social life, go on to succeed in her chosen career, travel the world, he's saying that that is less favorable to being decapitated on the basement of her brother's bedroom floor? That's where we see that there is a break in this man's psyche. That still, even after all this time waiting for the trial, yes, acknowledging his guilt, but still, he fails to recognize the magnitude of what he's actually done. He's stolen a future from this child. Now, the judge ultimately sentenced Randalich to 40 years in prison. Now, he will be required to serve straight time. That means there'll be no reductions for good behaviour at all. He's going to serve every single one of those days. Some of you might think that that's too little. Some of you may believe that that's too long. For me, what I know is that this is an unbelievably tragic case, especially for his mother. You know, her youngest child has been brutally murdered and her eldest has gone down for 40 years for murder. That means that effectively she has lost 2 children and she has to live with that sentence every single day of the week. Like I said at the very beginning of this, I have a level of confusion regarding Randalich. It's difficult to know what to make of him. When he was evaluated, he was diagnosed with a personality disorder. But I work with personality disorders all the time. The only harm that they are likely to cause is to themselves, not to others, And with respect, I hate it when, unless it's antisocial personality disorder, which we know can have horrible ramifications for society, but when we're looking at other types of personality disorder, I don't like them being wheeled in as a reasoning behind this kind of delusional behaviour. You can say, though, that he stuck to his...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Story all the way through. For whatever reason, he is fixated that he genuinely believes his sister was being abused, and that somehow, in his twisted way, the way he computes it through his mind, he believed he was protecting her by killing her. But there's a part of me that feels it seems too far-fetched to believe, because I guess it would be possible to introduce the fact that maybe he's simply a psychopath. He was angry after being told he couldn't have a gun. So for some reason, he decided that he was going to take out his frustrations on his little sister, who had no chance of fighting back. Maybe he resented her. You know, she had the same mother, different father. But throughout his interrogation, he did say that he never for a second thought about killing her until that night. Now, it could be that after he did kill her, he then decided that he wanted to create some kind of moral justification for his actions. Because it does seem that one of the things that is very present when he talks is that he does believe that he has this upper ground morally regarding justification for killing. He decided that it was all about ending his sister's alleged suffering. And if we're to think about those kind of variables, well, that kind of touches on what I would consider a highly narcissistic mentality, that you're God, you'll make the decision, that the law is the law, but if you feel that it's failing, then you will ensure that the justice that you believe needs to be served is served. And again, that's certainly a potential, isn't it? And we could argue, well, if that exists, well, there could be a possibility of psychopathy. I think what's hard in this case is that when I've watched the interrogations and done my research, there is something that I struggle with, and that is whether he feels any remorse whatsoever for his actions. Because that's the marker for me. It's the marker as to whether somebody can be rehabilitated. It's the marker as to whether anyone can ever be safe to walk the streets again. It's the cold, hard look in the mirror and the recognition of who you are, the capacity you've had, the damage you've done, and the recognition of the pain that that has caused. And then the willingness to make right for those actions. And that only comes when you truly believe what you did was wrong. And what I struggle with this man is I'm not sure that he really thinks that he did anything wrong. In fact, I am pretty sure he felt justified. Even though during the interrogation, he says he wasn't proud of what he had done, and he did at times with respect sound tearful, he certainly didn't seem like somebody who had literally just nearly decapitated his own sister. During that initial interrogation, he was sitting in clothes drenched in her blood. He was in an interrogation room facing a first-degree murder charge. Most people would be a gibbering wreck, falling to pieces. But he's calm. He's cool, collected, coherent. And again, that doesn't sit well, personality-wise, when I think about the kind of human being that would be able to hold all of those moments in that scenario and seemingly be able to communicate without effort. Randalich is currently incarcerated at the Pontiac Correctional Center. He'll be 58 years of age when he's released from prison. So he'll have a lot of life left. I mean, he'll be able to get married, potentially, have a career, live his life. Something that, without a doubt, he denied his sister. Just to note, whenever I do my research, I'm going to come across things that I cannot substantiate, but I thought I would say this just because it's in there. There have been recent rumours that he's recently died in prison, but I can't find one report that corroborates this. And right now, according to Illinois Department of Corrections, a 31-year-old Randalich is alive and is still serving his sentence. Like I said, I may be proven to be wrong about that, and that report that came up may have some truth, but right now I cannot confirm it, although arguably I cannot deny it. This has been one of those cases that I think for all of us with children and families, particularly if we're in step families, we kind of sit and it makes us recoil because we trust that our families are safe places and safe spaces. And don't get me wrong, of course, some families don't fit that paradigm. But certainly when you look at this one, there was nothing out of the ordinary. There were no red flags. There was nobody saying that Randalich was somebody with a premorbid fascination for murder. His actions didn't suggest that people needed to be concerned about his potential. And yet here we are in a scenario where that young man literally murdered his sister on an evening where everybody else just thought that nothing out of the ordinary was going to take place. That's the thing about life, isn't it? That the ordinary can suddenly become so extraordinary in a heartbeat. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.